Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. We call this the Icebreaker Show. We are saluting the National Science Foundation, running the research programs in Antarctica. They have the McMurdo Antarctic Station, Research Station. They need desperately to replace some supplies there. And in order to get the supplies there, they need a functional icebreaker. There is one icebreaker in the Coast Guard which can break the ice and get to the South Pole. Well, not the South Pole, to Antarctica. Russia, 50 icebreakers, several powered by nuclear reactors. The U.S., one. So you can see we are falling behind in this as we are in everything else. They're cost $1 billion apiece. They take 6 years to make, and we have only one. If it goes bad, then things are going to get a little bit rough down in the McMurdo station. So we decided, for no particular reason, to make the Icebreaker Show. This show contains a lot of things that would be good icebreakers at a party, things that you might want to, health facts you might want to talk about. We can at least have those kind of icebreakers, even if we can't have a real research icebreaker to help our folks, our research scientists at the South Pole. Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio and to debate and to break the ice for this show from the University of Kentucky, assistant professor with the Physician Assistant Program, Shelley Irving. Hi, Shelley.
Hello.
And welcome back from Isonville. We never got that report. I guess you never found cell service there.
No.
That was for the last couple of weeks.
But you didn't see the smoke signals?
I just thought your car had overheated. I had no idea. Here to explain how to interact with us on the web to get the ancient Health Matters shows and to chart our progress from the University of Kentucky, Interim Executive Director of Networking and Infrastructure, Rick Phillips. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tony. You know you can get the audio of the show from WMKY.org. That's right, Moorhead State Public Radio's website. Search through the menus, find the Health Matters show page. There you will find a list of all the most recent shows, a little summary with each one, but most importantly, you'll find a link to the audio. It's an MP3 file. If it's an MP3 player, or, well, it'll play on pretty much anything nowadays. The problem is, Tony, we started talking about this 14 years ago, and, you know, MP3s were a lot different back then. There was a lot of compatibility issues, and, well, you can only imagine. So anyway, put it on your device, sign up for the podcast, have it delivered to you automatically every week. It usually happens about 4 days after the show airs on Saturday morning. You've heard it. Now it's time to talk about it. Go over to facebook.com/HM Radio Show. There you will find a fan page devoted to Health Matters. You can leave feedback, comments, read some of the posts. Again, we do post things there from time to time that are both timely in the news or just interesting facts or sometimes just funny. You never can tell what you're going to find there, but the fan page is where you interact with the show. I'm sure Tony would love some help designing the shows. Send him some topics. He will put them in the show, whether you like it or not. So, again, you can find us facebook.com/HM Radio Show.
Our sponsor, the Tick Fixers, with their top 6 quick tick fixing tricks. I've got some news on ticks in our second fractional portion. You've got to stay tuned for this. Exciting tick news from Health Matters. But first, we're going to talk about how to get rid of those ticks. First thing we do is we talk about what not to do. Do not use sharp forceps. You do not want to puncture the tick. That's a bad idea. Do not crush or squeeze the tick's body. If you do that, then you're giving yourself an injection of tick guts, and that no good comes of that, simply. Its fluids, its saliva, its gut contents may contain infections. Number 3, do not apply noxious substances such as petroleum jelly, gasoline, nail polish, or other substances to the tick. This prolongs your exposure time and may cause the tick to eject infectious organisms into your body. In other words, you want to sneak up on this tick and just pluck it. You really don't want to make the tick suffer while it is still bit into you. Ticks have a respiratory rate. This is, once again, here's an icebreaker. Ticks have a respiratory rate of 3 to 15 breaths per hour. You're not going to suffocate a tick. If you want to wait, maybe put on some petroleum jelly and wait 3 to 5 hours, then perhaps the tick would start to turn. Well, ticks don't turn blue, do they? any rate, the tick would become uncomfortable under that petroleum jelly after a few hours. Do you really want to do that? No, you just want to pull this tick out. Don't apply heat with a match or a hot nail. Animal studies have demonstrated that irritating the tick with a lighted match, which may burn your skin or cause the tick to regurgitate its contents into your host, does not stimulate it to detach. This tick is actually cemented to your skin. It's not like it's going to back out the first time you scare it. It's going to stay there. You've got to pull it out. Don't use a twisting or jerking motion to remove the tick, and do not handle the tick with your bare hands. And I will say that's something I do all the time. I pull it, and then I take a look at it, try to figure out what kind of tick it is. And then I torture it for a while. And then I finally crush it. And all those things are unnecessary, but I still do them. And I'm sorry. I'm sorry to the ticks, and I'm sorry to our radio fans I do that.
Do you feel good once you've done that?
I feel better once I torture the tick.
When I see, you know, animals or, you know, see things in nature, you know, that are dead or experiencing, you know, injury or something like that, I always have this remorse and this kind of soft feeling inside, which, you know, I'm sure, Tony, you don't quite understand about me, but I do have that side, except when it comes to ticks. And I put them on the head of a match and light the match.
And I have to agree with you. You know, Rick, most people have a fly swatter. Rick has a little fly cozy that flies can sit in.
Actually, flies are just a couple steps down from ticks.
Fair enough,
but there's nothing. It just feels pretty good to let the tick crawl up on the tip of the match and then just light it.
We at Health Matters give you absolute permission to torture ticks, but you must do it safely. That's the thing. We want to make sure
I do it in the sink. I do it in the sink so that I can put the fire out if I need to.
Here's the thing. You know, we live in rural Kentucky. We have our own septic system. So this tick that breathes three times an hour, if I flush this tick,
he's going to come back and visit.
Yeah, this is now, the like nice one of thing old is, cartoons, you know, Tom and Jerry.
The nice thing is your septic tank is a long way from your bathroom there, or wherever you flushed him.
And
so
I don't
it's going to take him a year or two
I
to
used
get back to.
Yeah, but yeah. Still, it's just something you think about. Okay, very quickly, because we don't want to blow the entire fractional portion talking about ticks, avoiding tick bites. What to do? Number one, avoid tick bites. We'll talk more about that in our second fractional portion. Number two, remove the tick as soon as possible. And my wife and I do tick inspection after we come in from the woods or out in the fields. Do it that day. Number three, use a blunt angled forceps or a blunt pair of tweezers, not with a sharp tip. And number four, once the tick is removed, wash it. Wash the area to destroy any organisms and wash your hands as well. Number five, you do not need routine antibiotics. You might consider that in a person who's pregnant or has in an area that's high in tick-borne diseases. Our area is not that. Number six, the size and color of the tick help determine what kind of tick it is, and we'll talk more about that. Those are our top six quick tick-fixing tricks, and we have a more complete explanation in our second fractional portion, as well as some new information on ticks that you just simply have to hear. Now, we have, in the remainder of time we got in this fractional portion, we're going to be talking about alcohol. Because a couple of articles crossed my desk regarding alcohol, and I thought it was time to talk about it. This first one was a paper that was published in the European Union, and this is about European Union data, but the United States drinking rates are only secondary to those in Europe worldwide. So people need to be aware of this. Alcohol and digestive cancers across Europe, time for change, published 4th of July. More than one-fifth of the European population ages 15 years and older are drinking heavily at least once a week. There's not a single state within the European Union which has a light per capita alcohol consumption. Now, I'm talking to people in Kentucky, and we actually, despite our ability to make fine bourbon, we apparently can't afford to buy it because we have a lower-than-average rate of heavy drinking and a lower-than-average rate of alcohol consumption. It's not zero, but our rates of alcohol-related car crashes and other alcohol-related problems are somewhat lower than other states. That's good, but I want our radio fans to be aware of this. Heavy drinking, five or more drinks each day associated with an increased risk for pancreatic cancer, liver cancer, and stomach cancer. Particularly for those living in Eastern Europe, where the risk of dying from an alcohol-related cancer is seven times higher than the Mediterranean region of the European Union. The five most common digestive cancers in the world, colon cancer, esophageal, pancreatic, liver, and gastric cancer, are responsible for more than 3 million deaths annually, more than a third of cancer deaths globally. The number is going to rise, and Europe is the region with the heaviest alcohol consumption. And also, parts of the U.S. rival Europe. 30% of deaths from gastrointestinal diseases can be directly attributed to alcohol. You can't put something toxic like alcohol in your GI system and not pay a price. Now, we've talked a lot about the cardiovascular health benefits of alcohol. It's hit or miss. It's iffy, but some studies have shown a cardiovascular benefit. Cancer, there is no safe dose. There is no threshold. The more you drink, the higher your risk for these type of cancers. I so much want our radio fans to be aware of this, that the alcohol, I think the risk and benefits of alcohol have really been misstated, that they are higher on the cancer side than thought. And the idea of drinking for your health is, I won't say laughable, but I'm pretty close to that, I think.
And it doesn't matter what kind of alcohol you drink, right?
That's correct. You know, I mean, it's the amount of alcohol. So you take the mixed drinks that are higher in alcohol, the more actual alcohol you consume, then the higher the rates of cancer. That's the one constant. You'd have to drink quite a bit of wine then to approximate the amount of alcohol you get, say, with vodka, with bourbon, with whiskey, other things.
Yeah, I think the red wine's what's usually associated with the cardiovascular benefit, quote unquote.
Yeah, it's small. And I think if you're thinking for mixed drinks, you're thinking, well, I have a little alcohol for my heart. That doesn't seem to work very well at all.
But you've had three of them. You don't seem to care.
True. True.
Fair enough. But I think we have a kind of a cavalier attitude to alcohol. This is something that we know is a toxin. It's an irritant. Again, what do you do when you want to bother the ticks, Rick? You pour alcohol on them. That's one way to make a tick distressed. I'll put it that way.
Flames do a better job.
Well, you pour alcohol on them, then you get the match.
And oh, you don't need to do the alcohol. No sense torturing them.
But it's fun.
That's, I mean, let ticks live their life, however brief it might be after you find them. But in all seriousness, you know, I think we are cavalier about alcohol. It's a recreational substance. And the idea is, well, if you're not involved in a car crash, then there's no big deal. In fact, as a health measure, if you're stacking that up against, say, eating more eggs and you're worried about your cholesterol, or if you're worried about more vegetables or processed meats, alcohol, with its carcinogenic potential, is going to be right there with these other things. And you've heard in the U.S., you've heard campaigns against processed meats. We on this show have talked about it. You've heard people talking about red meat, heard them talking about more vegetables. You have not heard anything about alcohol and cancer in the United States. And this risk is huge, and the people in Europe are starting to look at it because they have fairly high drinking rates. But we haven't even talked about it in the U.S. Next up, and I got a little bit of time for this one, so I'm going to try to get this one in as well. This was Reuters Health News June 8th, and I saved it, and then I brought it up because of the GI cancer. Even moderate drinking was linked to changes in brain structure. This was a 30-year study. Looked at the brains of 550 middle-aged heavy drinkers, moderate drinkers, and teetotalers, and they could tell a difference in the brains of people who drank what you would consider to be a moderate amount. Again, this would be two drinks a day for men, one drink a day for women, one alcohol drink a day for women. And they found that even with that, the brain function, the brain structure, brain function showed a difference. So we at Health Matters cannot really endorse the health benefits of alcohol at any level, at any amount of consumption. There is that nasty problem with cancer. It does seem to have effects on the brain. It may have some beneficial cardiovascular effects, but you got to recognize you do not drink alcohol for health. What you do is take a break, because we're going to do that. We're going to come back with our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Icebreaker Show, where we are reminding our radio fans that our research base in Antarctica is in desperate need of an overhaul, and there is no money to do that in their current budget, to the point that there's only one icebreaker that will be able to deliver supplies. It is 40 years old. And has some maintenance issues. And meanwhile, it would take a substantial amount of money to create one of these really monster icebreakers it takes to get through there. Now, the good news is the South Pole is melting. You may have heard there was a huge the size of Delaware. The size of Delaware, that's not really that impressive anymore, is it? Because Delaware is really not that big. But there was an iceberg the size of Delaware that calved off.
Now there's a state floating around.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you should go.
I wonder if we could claim it.
Yeah. We would have to think of a fancy name for it.
Della Float? What do you think?
Health Matters on Ice.
Yeah. No, this sounds like a show you take the kids to. I'm not going to have that one because people are going to look that up. But at any rate, thanks for that. But who needs an icebreaker after all when the ice is doing a fine job on its home? Well, the folks at McMurdo Station do because they are dependent on that during the winter months and Antarctica to get their supplies. And unfortunately, we have only one vessel that's capable of doing it. Once the supplies get there, they need new buildings. They need new equipment. They're basically trying to make do with aging equipment from the 1960s and 70s and do top-level research. And this is part of our crumbling infrastructure, I guess, but one that you don't think about that much. Our sponsor, second time, the Tick Fixers, top six quick tick fixing tricks. We are talking about removing ticks. And let me, first of all, let's go ahead and get to the news that we have. This was July 11th in Reuters. Having a pet, dog or cat, doubles your odds that you will find a tick on you. This was Aaron Jones of Maryland Department of Mental Health and Hygiene in Baltimore looked at data from the CDC. There's a prevention initiative called TickNet. And they had questionnaires for people, how many times have you seen a tick? They surveyed 2,700 and change households in three states. This was high Lyme disease area, Connecticut, Maryland, and New York. More than half the households had a dog or a cat or both. 88% of them reported using some form of tick control on their pets. 31% of pet owners have found a tick crawling on a human. 19% of pet owners have found a tick attached to a human. 20% of non-pet owners and 14% found the crawling and the attached ticks. So again, it just about doubles your rate of finding ticks on you if you have a pet dog or pet cat.
Now, are these only the pets that are indoor and outdoor that are bringing them in?
It apparently is ownership, and it does not specify whether this was an indoor or an outdoor cat. No difference in tick-borne diseases reported by pet owners and non-owners. So more ticks, no diseases. Here are the other characteristics of the tick finders, I'll call them. If you have a vegetable garden, a compost pile, a log pile, a bird feeder, stone walls, and children's play equipment, all that a much higher risk of finding ticks. Now, I don't think ticks lurk on children's playground equipment, but I think playground equipment then means that you spend more time outside. And you could argue any pet means you spend more time outside. Maybe that's it. Let's go over our top six quick tick fixing tricks. Number one, avoiding tick bites is the key. Wear long pants, tuck your pant legs into your socks. We call that the Phillips look.
Yep.
To ward off. The one thing I have done is I do have some boots, muck boots that I use when I'm taking care of my horse. And if I'm going into high grass, I can take those things. They have a Velcro strap, and they'll go tied up against my calves, against my pants. And so I can create that barrier. I have yet to put my pants inside my socks. I just feel like that's going to stretch the socks and make me look weird.
More weird.
I beat you to that one. Wear long pants. Inspect the skin, especially the armpit and groin areas. We call those the fun areas, immediately after outdoor activities. If the skin exposure is unavoidable, use an insect repellent. And again, DEET, 10 to 35% DEET, adequate in most circumstances. 10% effective for 2 hours, 24% around 5 hours. And again, if you sweat it off or swim it off, you've got to reapply. Permethrin, really nice thing to do for socks and trouser cuffs. It will last for several washings before it comes out. Probably treatment of DEET to skin and permethrin to clothing, probably the most effective regimen. Number two, ticks are best removed as soon as possible, and your risk of disease transmission increases significantly after 24 hours of attachment. It is very hard for a tick to give you something within 5 or 6 hours. But after 24 hours, things start to go downhill. Number three, we talked about the blunt medium-tipped. They call them angled forceps. This is something we have in our doctor's office. If you are using pliers, needle-nose pliers, if you're using tweezers, just don't get those with a sharp tip on them. That's a bad idea. Following tick removal, inspect the bite area for any retained mouth parts. This commentary that I've got here says, well, you need to get rid of the mouth parts. I have recently read where that's not a big deal. If you get rid of the majority of the tick, you don't have to probe around and try to get every single body part off of your skin. The mouth parts don't really themselves transmit disease. So there is some disagreement with there. I would say I would not recommend a person break the skin and tear up the skin trying to get those mouth parts out. That's going to be more harm than good. Number four, once the tick is removed, wash the area. Person who removed the tick should wash his or her hands. Number five.
Do you do that?
Yeah, I do that. Because, see, I've been torturing the tick, and I know that I should do something that I should do.
You wash the area?
I wash the tick area, yeah, because it doesn't take but a second. So I'll do that. My problem, Rick, I'll tell you right now.
Just one?
You know, the station manager said, you know, you need to face away from Rick while you're talking, and so I'm right now just looking at a wall, and Rick is giving me these criticisms
the
over
difference?
My shoulder. And I find that's even more annoying when you're face to face, actually, Rick, because I'm going to try
to
stay.
Shelly's between us.
Yeah. I'm looking at the wall. I don't even know if Shelly's here or not.
Yeah.
Okay. But back to this. You know, if my tick problems were limited to dog ticks, I would not have tick problems. I have not seen a dog tick since probably mid spring. What I get is these little tiny pinpoint deer ticks or immature ticks. I don't know which it is. The Lone Star ticks have an immature form, and that thing just bites its way up your leg. It's a little pencil point sized brown dot that just wreaks havoc. And apparently I have this tremendous reaction to them because I'll get these big red blotches of skin, and they itch like nobody's business. That's been my problem. Dog ticks have not been my problem this year. Routine antibiotics, number five, not indicated following tick removal. And number six, we talked a little bit about this, brown and the size of a pencil point deer ticks, brown with a white collar and the size of a pencil eraser. These are the big old dog ticks, brown ticks that we were all grew up with. And a brown to black tick with a white splotch on its back, Lone Star tick, the immature form of Lone Star ticks, the folks around here call them turkey mites. They can swarm. They're in loose leaves, and they will swarm. Your leg will be filled with black dots, and it will start to burn up and feel bad. That is our sponsor, the Tick Fixers Top 6 Quick Tick Fixing Tricks. First thing to do is get rid of the dogs and cats, the kids, the playground equipment, the garden, the mulch pile, all that stuff. Just throw it out. And then secondly, remove the ticks and torture them, and then wash your hands. Also from the United Kingdom, more ice-breaking stuff. Again, we're talking about this ice-breaking show. It is more common, and I think this is true for the United States as well, it is more common for an individual to be diagnosed with cancer than to get married, to have a first child, or to be awarded a degree from a university, says a leading cancer charity in the United Kingdom, and I think this also applies to the United States. This will make sense. More common to be diagnosed with cancer than to get married.
That's depressing.
Well, I think some people would say, well, you know, I'm not going to do marriage jokes because there'd be plenty of those. But I think it is interesting to compare cancer to marriage. There's something a little unhealthy about this. I'm not sure the angle they're writing from, but that's what they said. This was published July 10th by Macmillan Cancer Support as part of an advertising campaign. They said, being told you have cancer changes your life. It can leave people feeling as if they've been thrust into the unknown, unprepared. In 2015, they had 360,000 people in the United Kingdom diagnosed with cancer. We obviously are much more populous than that. Around 35% of cancer cases are diagnosed in people younger than 65 years old. 2,000 children, they said, every year, again, in the United Kingdom. Cancer is divided almost equally among men and women. Half of these new cases are breast, prostate, lung, and bowel. The interesting thing about breast, prostate, lung, and bowel, every one of them has some method of screening now. Lung cancer, we screen with the CAT scan. Breast cancer with mammograms. Prostate cancer, we've done the PSA and the rectal exams. We're not sure if that's helpful because prostate cancer has a fairly high survival rate. It tends to kill older people. And then bowel cancer, we screen with colonoscopy or with stool test or with x-ray test. So we have these screening tests, but more than half of all new cases are those four types of cancers. Now, here's the thing, Shelley. We talked about this before the show started. 37% of the general public says that cancer is the disease they fear the most. Dementia at 27%, stroke and heart disease at 11% each. Among those with cancer, 23% said they felt as if their life was effectively over when they were diagnosed. Now, we're talking about five-year survivals of 89% with breast cancer, 99% with prostate cancer, in the 60s with colon cancer, and yet people, and those are three of the most common forms of cancer, but people still feel their life is over when cancer is diagnosed.
Yeah, we've really educated people that cancer is bad, and I think they've learned that. But it's so common now. You know, we just need to re-educate people, I think.
Yeah, now you take lung cancer or pancreatic cancer. First of all, if we can change lung cancer. If we don't smoke, it goes away. If we screen for it with CAT scans, we can pick it up early and change the survival rates. But right now, lung cancer, in 5 years, around 84% of people that are diagnosed will be dead in 5 years. Pancreatic cancer, same thing. 84-85% will be dead in 5 years. Prostate cancer, 11% dead in 5 years. Prostate cancer actually 1% in 5 years.
Yeah, I was going to say, I thought that number sounded high.
Yeah, thanks for helping with the math.
You had it right twice.
Yeah, I was close, but I rounded up the percentage point and forgot the decimal.
Maybe you just forgot the decimal. Maybe it was 1.1.
Yeah, anyway, but 1% die in 5 years of prostate cancer, and breast cancer 11%. So you think about that. That leaves a lot of people who are still going to be alive, and I don't mean just hanging on vegetables, getting chemotherapy, and so forth. I mean people who are actively out and living. 89%, 99% of these common cancers, they're going to still be alive. And yet a quarter of people feel like cancer diagnosis that's the death sentence. There's really the end of functional life. There's a brief period to arrange your affairs and go. I think we need to, as you said, Shelley, we've got to educate about the bad cancers and the good cancers. People got to recognize that. We've got to have people understand about the goals of cancer care. But in many cases, we can push, even if we can't cure these cancers, we can certainly push back the time when you no longer are able to do anything because of them.
Yeah, and the whole point of screening is to catch it early so you can do something about it.
Yeah.
You know, not to get a death sentence, but so we can prevent that.
Yeah. You know, here in Eastern Kentucky, we have the high rates of lung cancer, which has the bad prognosis. It makes it hard for people to think that any type of cancer has a decent prognosis. But you can have these cancers caught at an early stage, or you can have other cancers that aren't really stage dependent. There may not be a screening test, but we still have treatments for them. It is not true. Again, 23% life is effectively over when you're diagnosed. No.
I didn't say anything. You just
said
no.
I said no, and I turned around and looked at Rick just to make sure he heard me say no.
If you would face the right way when we're talking.
You know, I sort of like this doing it myself. This way I don't have to worry about Rick or Shelley interjecting something that really doesn't relate to what I'm talking about.
I was going to ask if you had something happier to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, he's always like this. He brings this bad stuff. Can we talk about something fun?
I'm telling you, people with...
Summer's almost over,
people
Tony.
Diagnosed with cancer can live. All right, if you want something... Well, no, I don't have anything. Let's just go to the next one then, if you don't... This is July 10th Journal of Neuroscience, and I like this. I think people need to know this, but it's not happy. Karen Lerman, who's University of Pennsylvania, was looking at these brain training things, and they look specifically at lumosity. And these games are supposed to work on your working memory, your attention, your flexibility, your problem solving, your short-term memory. They've got these video lumosity games that you're supposed to do, and you do a certain packet of them. It takes a half an hour. So they took 128 people. Now, one of the problems is these were 25-year-olds. These are not middle-aged people, but these are 25-year-old people. And they gave them the lumosity game, gave half of them the lumosity game. The other half, they said, hey, play some video games. Play 30 minutes of video games once a week.
See, now we're talking about good things.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. So
everybody likes video games.
Now, the neat thing about it, which I really liked, was they treated them exactly the same way. They said, okay, lumosity is going to make your brain stronger. It's going to increase your cognitive abilities and so forth. And then they turned to the other group and they said, all right, I want you to realize these video games, you can pick whatever, but we know that video games, or we believe video games, are going to increase your brain flexibility and so forth. So each group was working with the knowledge acknowledge that they might be improving their brain. They all got reminders, be sure and do your brain stuff, except some of them were sitting there plunking down solitaire cards or shooting deer or aliens or whatever you do on those video games. And then some of them were doing the Lumosity sessions. Neither group knew that that there was another group. They kept the two groups separate. And then they did something called functional MRI scanning. They had them figure out if they wanted to have a lot of money later or a smaller amount of money immediately. And people had to think about and calculate how they would spend the money and so forth. And they had them do that in an MRI scanner. And they watched to see how much of their brain lit up when they were doing something complicated like that. They then had them take an hour cognitive battery, a bunch of tests of attention, working memory, response, inhibition, and so forth, and they found no effects of the Lumosity. Lumosity and just random video games were exactly the same.
How long had this gone on for?
They did it. Hang on just a second, Rick. Thanks for asking. They're 30-minute sessions. They did them once a week. They did them for... the 1 week run in, and then 50 sessions over 10 weeks.
Okay.
That is a lot of video games. Then they had them, they looked at the MRI data and the same thing. These guys were doing mathematical calculations, trying to figure things out, and the MRI scanner showed the exact same amount of brain metabolism. They said, no, we don't see any signs of improvement in Lumosity.
Is that a reasonable thing to expect? Would your brain make a distinction between not doing math and doing math while you're in an MRI with the noise that it makes?
Yeah, well, what they
distraction?
I mean, I understand that the MRIs are pretty noisy, but
They were when I had one a long
time
ago.
Sure, but what they're trying, and also claustrophobic, I think it would be very hard to be doing mathematical calculations when this giant machine is about to crush you, which is what you feel like in an MRI scanner. But they tried to do this mathematical calculations, and it looks like the metabolism's about the same. Now, you know, one of the problems is, again, these were 25-year-old kids. So whether or not a lot of the Lumosity people are older, middle-aged people that are trying to stave off dementia and things like that. But there is no evidence that it works, and now there is some evidence that it doesn't work. Apparently, you can just shoot down aliens for 30 minutes for 10 weeks or whatever, and you could have about the same effect on your brain.
When you're 25.
Yeah, when you're 25. Good point. I don't know, you know, would you expect that? I guess my point is if they at age 25 were training their brains to do something, I can tell you right now, I can't train my brain to do anything. Meanwhile, we're going to take a break and improve our brains. We'll come back with our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Icebreaker Show. We are saluting our brave and intrepid explorers in Antarctica. The scientists that go down there and study science, knowing full well that they don't have the facilities that they need, nor do they have a guaranteed safe line of resupply. Just reminding you, this is comes from the National Science Foundation. They would like to upgrade the McMurdo Scientific Research Station in Antarctica, but they do not have the funding to do so. They have only one icebreaker that can break the heavy sea ice and get to the station. That's the Coast Guard's Polar Star. It is 40 years old and called by crew members a rust bucket, which is not necessarily a term of affection. Our sponsor for the final time, the Tick Fixers with their top six quick tick fixing tricks. And I'm going to run through these quickly. Number one, avoiding ticks is the key. Remember to wear long pants, tuck your pant legs in your socks, inspect your skin. If you are going to be exposed, put DEET on the skin, permethrin on the clothing. That's the best thing that you do. Number two, remove the tick as soon as possible, and your risk of getting an infection from the tick increases after 24 hours of attachment. Number three, use a pair of tweezers or a forceps. Don't scrape the tick off. Don't irritate the tick. Number four, once it's removed, wash the area with soap and water. Wash your hands as well. Number five, routine antibiotics not recommended for people in Kentucky. Might consider them in pregnant patients or if you've traveled, if you picked up the tick at an area where there's a high infection rate. And number six, the size and color. Remember the pencil eraser size tick, those big brown ticks, those are dog ticks. They can carry diseases. There are some pencil point ticks that are very hard to identify. It's hard to see those things. I guess the good part, if we can call it good, is that at least for me, I produce such a violent reaction that I can immediately tell that I have, or within a few hours can tell I have a tick on me because my skin is basically itchy and about to fall off. That is our top six quick tick fixing tricks from the Tick Fixers. And a reminder from our second fractional portion, if you own a dog, if you have a garden, if you have playground equipment, your risk of getting a tick is about double that of a person who doesn't own a pet or have those outdoor features in their yard. However, your risk of getting disease apparently is about the same. Now, the diseases are much more rare than the ticks, so this is not necessarily an all-clear sign. It's not necessarily that it's safe, but we have not been able to measure a uptick, as we would call it, in your risk of getting tick-borne diseases. Rick, how about coffee?
Love it.
You do, don't you?
Yep.
How many cups a day?
Well, that's a tough question to answer. Here's how the math works out for me. So I switched over to K-cups a while back, right? But the K-cups tend to be really strong. Even the mild and the medium roasts tend to be stronger than I like my coffee because I drink coffee black. I don't put cream or sugar or water it down or any of that stuff. So a really strong coffee is not something that I really like. So I tend to, what I basically do is I run my K-cup twice, and so I ended up with a 20-ounce coffee that's been run
twice. This explains a lot of that irritability. Can I just say
and
that?
And let the record reflect, I only do that twice a day.
Okay.
So I only drink 40 ounces of coffee a day.
Very reasonable. I mean, who could possibly balk at 40 ounces of coffee?
That's like three Mountain Dews or something, you know?
Pretty much. Shelly?
Aren't you glad you asked? Uh-huh.
Yeah, I like the explanation. It killed a lot of time.
I love coffee, too.
See, this is what hurts me. I never developed a taste for coffee, and I'm regretting that and regretting that. Two studies.
Life is better with coffee.
Yeah. Annals of Internal Medicine, July 10th, two studies. We know, coffee obviously consumed worldwide. Even if it has only a small health-promoting effect, that could be pretty substantial because of the high number of people that consume coffee. Their higher coffee consumption in previous studies was associated with a lower risk for all-cause death. But what about diverse populations? Is this true for European and American white people, but what about other populations? So a first study, 185,000 people. African Americans, 17% or more, Native Hawaiians, 7%, Japanese Americans, 29%, Latinos, 22%, and 25% whites, aged 45 to 75, and they were recruited between 1993 and 1996, and they just measured their coffee consumption and watched them. 16% did not drink coffee. That would be me, unfortunately. 31% drank one cup a day. I guess that would be Rick if the cup were the size of a football field.
Or a football. I mean, either one.
25% drank 2 to 3 cups a day, 7% drank 4 or more cups a day, and 21% had irregular drinking habits, coffee drinking habits. They followed them from 1993 to 2012, and 16 years average follow-up, 58,000 deaths occurred in these 45 to 75-year-old people. And after they match it up, one cup a day of coffee drops your risk of dying by around 12%. 2 to 3 cups a day, 18%, and then 4 or more, it's flat. It's also 18% lower risk of dying. Both caffeinated and decaffeinated coffee, same thing. No difference. The association held for all the ethnic groups except Native Hawaiians. Native Hawaiians did not respond to coffee. Now, when you do science, it just gets ugly sometimes. It doesn't make sense. Why would Hawaiians not respond to coffee, whereas Japanese Americans would?
I never did like Hawaiian roast.
Never smokers. You made me turn around. That has nothing to do with anything. I'm sure I'm insulted on behalf of our listeners. Never smokers, people younger than 55 years, those without chronic disease, also had an inverse relationship. So it's not that you drink coffee when you're near death or anything like that.
Hope not.
It lowered the risk for death due to heart disease, cancer, respiratory disease, stroke, diabetes, and kidney disease. I mean, coffee, this is an observational study. Maybe these people who happen to drink coffee also happen to do a lot of other good things. But for whatever reason, coffee is linked to a lot of good things. Second study, coffee intake and mortality risk in European populations, and I seem to be talking a lot about European populations. This was 500,000 people, ages 35 and older. Same thing. Lower all-cause mortality. And again, it was around 12% among men, about 7% among women who drank coffee. And deaths due to digestive disease was lower in the coffee group. Now, they said, due to the limitations of observational research, understand, we don't know if coffee drinkers are doing something else that's good or if it's the coffee itself. But due to the limitations of observational research, which I didn't have any trouble saying last when I started this segment, we are not at the stage of recommending people drink more or less coffee. That said, our results suggest moderate coffee drinking is not detrimental to your health. I mean, I am at the stage, Rick. I am at the stage where I can tell you, you should drink coffee. We should probably teach our kids to drink coffee.
I wished you would have come around to the way I think a long time ago.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I've been
tried
drinking coffee
it.
Since I was, like, in the Army.
I kept trying. It burns my tongue. And that is just the most irritating.
You can have an iced coffee. That's okay.
Yeah, I know. I feel like that's stale coffee. You know, that's
well, the
that's
problem
like
with the iced coffees is they put all the stuff in them. These studies aren't, I mean, I suspect the minute you start loading them with cream and sugar and caramel and mocha and, you know, get all that out of your coffee. Have a real cup of coffee.
Well,
Java.
And Shelly, I understand what you're saying, but even if they don't put the stuff in that Rick's talking about, these studies were done in the 1990s. I mean, the study started in the 1990s. These people drank hot coffee.
Well, as I say, there wasn't a ton of foo-foo coffee back then.
Foo-foo coffee.
That's what it is. I mean, it's $5. I mean, Starbucks.
Right, that wasn't even convincing. When you look at the data, the evidence we have for coffee, it is greater at this point than anything else you can drink. It just is.
I totally agree with you.
Yeah, and I'm going to try again. I'll try to let it cool enough. Anybody's got any secrets for how coffee doesn't burn your tongue, please send it to me because I really want to be a coffee drinker. Embarrassing
just drop one ice cube in the cup.
You don't like it? It's just you don't like it because it gets really hot?
Yeah. I mean, who wants to? Right now, usually when I drink, I will tell you something. Usually when I drink fluids, I want to cool down. I rarely drink fluids to warm up. That's just not what I do. So, yeah, if I were spending a lot of time outdoors in the wintertime, I'd brace myself with a warm cup of coffee. But right now, it's July, and I don't feel like drinking anything hot. I don't even feel like eating things hot. That's stupid.
I don't understand. You work, and all your life you have worked in a 72-degree environment. You're not out in the sun when you're working.
Well, I don't drink when I'm in the office. I don't need to.
You
it's
should.
70
That's
degrees.
When you should do it. Don't you ever take a break, a federally mandated break, I might add?
No, wait a second. All right, here we go now. Let's roll this forward a little bit. No, as a matter of fact, when I get started on a project,
you don't take your federally mandated break.
You've got to see. I mean, I turned around to look at this, and Rick looks like some kind of a railroad crossing.
Who are you He's going to get in trouble by saying no to this?
As it turns out, I do take my federal, but I was saying if I didn't, I would just sit at my desk and work on stuff.
See, now I'm just taking advantage of somebody who doesn't really understand the federal law around this because you're an exempt worker, so
I don't even get a federally mandated
break.
You're
one of the 13 professions that is actually exempt. You don't have to take a break by federal law.
Oh, thank God.
But you're right up there with the lawyers and, you know, dentists.
Back to it. I will, you know, when I'm at work, I have switched from soft drinks to I drink green tea. It doesn't help. I know that. You know, the kind of green tea that I've got, which is
you ever
not freshly
why it's
brewed.
Not green?
Well, it looks like pond water. And
it's not
it
green,
tastes
though.
Okay. Mm-mm. No, it's not really. But there's a black tea, and it's not black. It's kind of brown. But I'm talking about coffee. Coffee, if my mom had got me started on coffee when I was young and convinced me in some way that coffee was grown up, or even if she'd forbidden coffee, I guess I would have done it to spite her. I think I would be a healthier guy. I think if I drank coffee, I probably, once your tongue gets burned, you can't eat stuff. I mean, there's no point in eating pastries.
Tony, I don't like hot coffee. I actually don't like really hot coffee. I let my coffee sit for like 5 or 10 minutes before I drink it. Or I think the best cup of coffee you can have in the world is served out of a ceramic mug, because then it cools down very fast. So the idea of when you get coffee in a restaurant in a ceramic cup, it actually cools off fast enough to where you don't burn your mouth when you drink it. Within a minute, really, a ceramic mug will cool the coffee down enough to where it's drinkable.
You're saying that you get a ceramic mug because it has transference properties. It's not insulated, so the coffee cools more rapidly.
Absolutely.
I mean, a stainless steel mug would transfer the whole thing to the table, right?
No. One of these stainless steel.
Now they got a vacuum in the middle, so they.
You buy one of these really fancy things, and you can drive to Lexington. It'll still burn your tongue when you drink it.
All right, but that ceramic mug is not hot on the outside, so I don't know how it's transferring the heat out of the coffee.
No, a ceramic cup. You know, just a regular ceramic coffee cup. That's the way God intended coffee to be drank.
I don't know how God intended coffee to be drunk, but
it's been around since his son.
Coffee's been around a long time. It's been around. That's not the point. That's really not the point. The point is it's healthy, and that irks me because it's so nasty. My mother and my mother-in-law would come visit, and I have to clean up this coffee, and they get coffee stains absolutely everywhere. It is a mess.
Didn't your mother chew tobacco? Are you sure that was coffee?
Can you get us off the air, please?
We still have some time. You still got.
I don't
like
care.
2 minutes.
I don't care whether we got time or not.
You still got like 2 minutes.
I'm just saying. Okay. All right. So let's go back and let's. Again, just to summarize, two big studies in the Annals of Internal Medicine indicate that coffee is associated with a lower risk of dying, which is a pretty good thing. Now, they're observational studies, and I emphasize that. And the way we think about observational studies at Health Matters, professional basketball players, I observe, wear large shoes. It is not true that if I put on some large shoes, I could play basketball in the NBA. You know that. That's absurd. And in the same way, coffee drinkers live longer. I'm not sure if I drank coffee if I could live longer, but it looks to me like the evidence points that way, and it's certainly stronger than for anything else we could consume, anything else that we could drink. So it makes sense to do that. One more thing, and this is not much, but this is Ohio State University. And you know what kind of research comes out of Ohio State. They fed male mice a diet of 10% tomato powder for 35 weeks. So there's a thrill right there. 10% tomato powder, 35 weeks. And then they exposed them to ultraviolet light. These poor mice had no idea what was going on. Had a 50% decrease in their risk of skin cancer. You know how mice, you know, fear skin cancer. These mice, 50% lower rates of skin cancer. Turns out the female mice, no change. But the male mice did. They said, gee whiz, tomatoes apparently reduce your risk of skin cancer.
There's a joke there with suntan lotion or something, but I can't
figure it out. There's all kinds of stuff.
Out.
Tomatoes are probably a good thing. Coffee's probably better, I'll be honest. Let's face it.
You know, that warms my heart because I don't really like, I mean, I like my tomatoes in ketchup.
Right, a tomato
pasta,
smoothie, we call it.
Or on pasta.
Go, Rick.
Are you really? You really want me to go?
We need to leave. We really do.
If we just have to, here we go. Special thanks to our Morehead State Public Radio producer, Sean Delaney, and to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember,
Health Matters is an injectable prescription radio show used to treat adult patients with moderate to severe eczema whose disease is not well controlled with prescription shows used on the ear or who cannot use radiotherapies. It is not known if Health Matters is safe and effective in children.
Health Matters can rarely cause serious side effects, including eye problems.
Tell your healthcare provider if you have any new or worsening eye problems, including eye pain or changes in vision.
The most common side effects include listening site reactions, eye and eyelid inflammation, including redness, swelling, and itching, and cold sores on your mouth or on your lips.
Listen to Health Matters exactly as prescribed. If your healthcare provider decides that you can listen to our show, you or your caregiver should receive training on the right way to prepare and use your radio. Do not try to listen to Health Matters until you have been shown the right way by your healthcare provider.
Before listening to Health Matters, tell your healthcare provider about all your medical conditions, including if you have
having eye problems,
have a parasitic infection,
have asthma,
are scheduled to receive any vaccinations. You should not receive a live vaccine if you are treated with Health Matters.
Are pregnant or plan to become pregnant, it is not known whether Health Matters will harm your unborn baby.
Are breastfeeding or plan to breastfeed, it is not known whether Health Matters passes into your breast milk.
Read the patient information leaflet, if available, from your pharmacist before you start listening to our show, and each time there is a break. If you have any questions, consult your doctor or pharmacist.
Whatever you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for more exciting news from the world of medical research on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.